Greetings and oblometallical psychofenestrations, my jocularly matriculated listeners. Welcome to this December 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this unremittingly hypo-subsidized science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome to you all. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to each and every one of our listeners. Let's start out with a story that is related to one that we have been covering for a number of years. You may remember from last month and previous podcasts that I have spoken about human ancestors and contamination of Homo sapien DNA due to, well, hookups with our various ancient relatives, like the Neanderthals to a greater extent, and the Denisovans, a distant cousin of the Neanderthals to a lesser extent. Well, it turns out if you do some digging into the human genome, you can find traces of ancient non-Homo sapien ancestors who are neither Neanderthals or Denisovans. Imagine that. Dr. Ryan Bolander of University of Texas reported this month that people from Melanesia in the South Pacific may carry genetic evidence of a previously unknown extinct hominid species. Cue the oohs and ahs. Ryan reported that, quote, the new species is not Neanderthal or Denisovan, but a different, related hominid group. We're missing a population, or we're misunderstanding something about the relationships. Human history is a lot more complicated than we thought it was, unquote. The article says that this mysterious relative was probably from a third branch of the hominid family tree that produced Neanderthals and Denisovans, an extinct, distant cousin of Neanderthals. Even though lots of Neanderthal fossils have been found in Europe and Asia, you may remember that back in 2015, I reported the discovery of the Denisovans. And the Denisovans are known only from DNA from a finger bone and a couple of teeth found in a Siberian cave. Bolander calculates that Europeans and Chinese people carry a similar amount of Neanderthal ancestry, about 2.8%. Europeans have no hint of Denisovan ancestry, and people in China have a tiny amount, about a tenth of a percent, according to Bolander's calculations. But 2.74% of the DNA in people in Papua New Guinea comes from Neanderthals, and Bolander estimates that the amount of Denisovan DNA in Melanesians is about 1.11%, not the 3-6% estimated by other researchers. While investigating this disagreement with other research in the Denisovan DNA, Bolander concluded that a third group of hominids may have bred with the ancestors of Melanesians. Of course, if you think about it, all the speculation about new unknown hominids may be just so much nonsense. I mean, we really don't have enough information about ancient human-related species to be making judgment calls like that. Remember what I said a minute ago, DNA has been examined from just a few Neanderthal fossils, and worse, the Denisovan remains have been found in only one Siberian cave from one individual. For all we know, Denisovans may have been widespread, genetically diverse. It's kind of hard to judge from one finger bone. Anyway, if that were the case, the Papuans' DNA could have come from a Denisovan population that had been separated from the Siberian Denisovans for long enough so that they looked like distinct groups. Just like European and Asians today are genetically different from each other. However, still, if Denisovans were not that genetically diverse across the world, the mysterious extinct ancestor could well be another species. Let's change gears completely and talk about astronomy news. Dr. Christopher Colice of the University of Nottingham reported October 10th in the online journal Archive that the newest count for galaxies in our observable universe is 2 trillion. This updated headcount is roughly 10 times greater than previous estimates and suggests there are a lot more galaxies out there for future telescopes to explore. Hordes of relatively tiny galaxies, with as few as a million suns, were responsible for most of this tweaking to the cosmic census. Astronomers haven't directly seen these galaxies yet. Consolice combined data from many ground and space-based telescopes to look at how the number of galaxies in a typical volume of the universe has changed over much of cosmic history. His group then calculated how many galaxies have come and gone in the universe. They found that the galaxy population has dwindled over time, as most of those 2 trillion galaxies collided and merged to build larger galaxies like the Milky Way. That's in line with prevailing ideas about how massive galaxies have been assembled. Seeing many of these remote runts, however, is beyond the ability of even the next generation telescope at the moment. Consolice says, quote, "We will have to wait at least several decades before even the majority of galaxies have basic imaging," unquote. And the next story is directly related to the previous one, and it is about these dim galaxies. And we're working on a theme here. As Consolice discovered, not all galaxies are quite as lit up with stars as the Milky Way or the Andromeda, one of our nearest intergalactic neighbors. These sad, dark galaxies have no grand spirals of stars and gas wrapped around a glowing core, nor are they radiant balls of densely packed stars. Instead, they possess just sad wisps of starlight. Poetic, isn't it? The first of these dark galaxies was discovered in 2015. But since then, over 1,000 more of these dark, star-starved giants have been found. Dr. Roberto Abraham of the University of Toronto, who has recently reported a study of these diffuse galaxies in Astrophysical Science Letters, says, quote, "If you took the Milky Way but threw away about 99% of the stars, you'd get one of these dark galaxies," unquote. How these dark galaxies form is unclear. They could be a whole new type of galaxy that challenges ideas about the birth of galaxies, or they might be outliers of already familiar galaxies, sort of like black sheep shaped by their environment. And wherever they come from, dark galaxies appear to be pretty ubiquitous. They're all over. Abraham says that these quote-unquote ghost galaxies are puzzling on many fronts. Any galaxy the size of the Milky Way should have no trouble creating lots of stars. But it's still unclear how heavy dark galaxies are. Perhaps these shadowy entities are failed galaxies, as massive as our own but mysteriously prevented from giving birth to a vast stellar family. Or despite being as wide as the Milky Way, they could be relative lightweights, stretched thin by internal or even external forces. Either way, with so few stars, Abraham says it is clear that so-called dark galaxies must have enormous deposits of unseen matter to resist simply being pulled apart by the gravity of other galaxies. From what researchers have learned so far, dark galaxies seem to have been lurking for many billions of years. They're located throughout their home clusters, suggesting that they've had a long time to spread out among the other galaxies. And the meager stars that they have are mostly red, indicating that they're pretty old. With this kind of long-term survival, dark galaxies probably have some sort of strength that's holding them together. Again, probably dark matter. All galaxies are loaded with dark matter, this mysterious substance that reveals itself only through gravitational interaction with gas and stars. A lot of that dark matter sits in an extended blob that reaches well beyond the visible edge of a galaxy. Astrophysicists say that, on average, dark matter accounts for about 85% of all the matter in the universe. Abraham says that dark matter must make up about 98% of the mass of a dark galaxy for there to be enough gravity to keep it intact. Dark galaxies appear to have similar fractions of dark matter focused near their cores as the Milky Way does throughout its broader halo. For example, one dark galaxy that Abraham has studied, Dragonfly 44, weighs roughly 1 trillion times the mass of the Sun, but glows with a mere 1% of our galaxy's stars. At this point, astronomers have found a total of 854 dark galaxies, 332 of which appear to be roughly the size of our Milky Way. Abraham finishes with, quote, "As our telescopes get bigger and more space telescopes become available, we think we will find more and more ultra-diffuse galaxies. We don't know how many there are, but we know there are a lot of them. And there could be even more dark galaxies than bright ones out there," unquote. Next story. You may remember a couple of months ago, I reported that some Israeli computer security experts were able to hack a computer by listening to its cooling fan. This probably freaked out many of you who already put tape over your webcam and are worried about your government, or the Illuminati for that matter, hacking your Wi-Fi to watch over you. If you are truly worried about hackers spying on you, some of you may have even opened up your computers or phones to disable or remove built-in audio components so that they can't be hijacked by hackers. Well, Dr. Mordechai Gurry of Ben-Gurion University's Cybersecurity Lab in Israel has come up with a new hack for you to be worried about. His group has written a beautiful piece of malware that converts your headphones into makeshift microphones that can slyly record your conversations. Gurry wrote a program called Speaker, designed to demonstrate how determined hackers could find a way to surreptitiously hijack a computer to record audio even when the device's microphones have been entirely removed or disabled. The experimental malware instead repurposes the speakers in earbuds or headphones to use them as microphones, converting the vibrations in the air into electromagnetic signals to clearly capture audio from across a room. Gurry says, quote, "People don't think about this privacy vulnerability. Even if you remove your computer's microphone, if you use headphones, you can still be recorded," unquote. It can't really be much of a surprise to you listeners out there that this is possible. Even I have seen YouTube videos that demonstrate how earbuds can function as microphones if you're in some sort of an emergency pinch. Gurry reminded me that, quote, "Just as the speakers and headphones turn electromagnetic signals into sound waves through a membrane's vibrations, those membranes can also work in reverse, picking up sound vibrations and converting them back into electromagnetic signals," unquote. Gurry took this a step further. His malware uses a little-known feature of the Realtek audio codec chips to silently retask the computer's output channel as an input channel, allowing the malware to record audio even when the headphone remains connected to an output-only jack and there's not even a microphone channel on their plug. Gurry says the Realtek chips are so common that the attack works on practically any desktop computer. And it doesn't matter whether it runs Windows or Mac OS. It does seem to be most laptops. Gurry says, quote, "This is a real vulnerability. It's what makes almost every computer today vulnerable to this type of attack. And this is not fantasy. I saw a photo earlier this year that Mark Zuckerberg had put tape over his laptop's microphone. I also watched a video of Edward Snowden demonstrating how to remove the internal mic from a smartphone. Even the NSA's Information Assurance Division suggests hardening PCs and Macs by disabling their microphones," unquote. Gurry reported his team tried the audio hack with a pair of Sennheiser headphones. They found they could record from as far as 20 feet away and even compress the resulting recording and send it over the internet like a hacker would, and still distinguish the words spoken by a voice. Gurry finishes with telling us that there's no simple software patch for the eavesdropping attack. The property of Realtek's audio codec chips that allows a program to switch an output channel to an input isn't an accidental bug so much as a dangerous feature that Realtek put in there. And it's one that can't be easily fixed without redesigning and replacing the entire chip in future computers. All right, all you paranoiacs listening to me, take note. If determined hackers are out there to bug your conversations, all your careful computer microphone removal surgery isn't going to be quite enough, according to Gurry. You're going to need to do that last one thing, and that is unplug that cheap pair of earbuds hanging around your neck. Next story, courtesy of Nike. Well, all right, not really. Nike and other sneaker brands don't really care how you run, just that you buy their sneakers and run. So, Dr. James Weber of the University of Arizona reports in the November issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology that humans run heel-toe and not toe-heel for a reason. Weber has been a barefoot runner for a decade, although, frankly, I have no idea how barefoot running is possible on any street anywhere, let alone in Arizona, where the average street temps can literally fry eggs. But that's not the point. Weber noted that to run barefoot, you have to run heel-toe to be more comfortable, and that didn't seem to be a problem energetically. So he wondered why almost everyone runs heel-toe instead and not toe-heel. Is there some mechanical advantage that he doesn't know or understand? Weber says in the article that walking humans effectively move like, quote, an inverted swinging pendulum, unquote, pivoting above the foot that is in contact with the ground as we step forward. He explains that when we transfer our weight forward from heel to toe, the center of pressure slides across the sole of the foot. And Weber reasoned that that could mean that the true center of pendulum rotation is effectively several centimeters beneath the ground. And he wondered whether our conventional flat-footed style of walking effectively lengthens the leg. If that's true, then it may improve our efficiency and allow us to walk faster than if we walk toe first, like, well, lots of animals do. Weber observed what happened to walkers when they reversed their normal footfall patterns to walk like ballet dancers, landing on the ball of the foot first before allowing the heel to touch down. Weber recruited 14 volunteers to try out the novel walk. He then filmed them walking over speeds ranging from a gentle 8/10 of a meter per second walk to a brisk 1.5 meters per second walk, before asking them to revert to their more conventional heel-toe pattern. Calculating the effective leg length of the volunteers as they walk conventionally and then toe first, Weber was impressed to see that the walkers' legs were effectively 15 centimeters longer when their heel hit the ground first. When he compared the cost of the two styles of locomotion, the toe-first walkers were having to work 10% harder when they landed on the heel first. Weber also asked the volunteers to walk on a treadmill as he slowly increased speed until they had to shift up into a running gear because it was no longer efficient to continue walking. And he found that they switched to a run at lower speeds when touching down with the front of the foot first, suggesting that toe-first walking was less efficient than conventional walking. So according to Weber, we appear to gain mechanical benefit of longer legs when landing on the heel first while walking because weight is transferred forward along the foot during a stride, which effectively shifts the stride pivot point several centimeters beneath the sole of the foot to extend the virtual leg. Weber ends the paper suggesting that our unusual running style could be a relic of our evolutionary past, explaining that the combination of a heel-to-toe gait and the long rigid foot appears to be essential for economical walking in our ancient ancestors. He says, quote, I suspect that early humans retained the unusual posture despite developing shorter toes to generate a stronger push-off when they took up running in pursuit of prey, unquote. This next short report was published in the journal Nature last month,
and it's really a story of mistaken identity.
Gaëtan Dugas. He was a flight attendant from Canada who supposedly contracted HIV in Haiti or Africa and brought the virus to the U.S. to his death in 1984. And basically, the poor guy has been considered patient zero or the only AIDS case outside of California for many years. If you don't know what patient zero is, it means that it's the carrier or the original source for an infectious disease. So poor Mr. Dugas has been the Judas goat that everyone has pointed to as bringing HIV to the U.S. Given that there were thousands of cases observed on both the East and the West Coast, Dr. Michael Worobi of the University of Arizona set out to determine the true origin of HIV by analyzing blood samples of individuals that passed away from HIV in the 1970s and 80s. Worobi and his colleagues used a new, unique sequencing approach, which they called RNA jackhammering, to reconstruct the HIV-1 genome from blood samples. From these sequences, the authors found that HIV-1 infections in San Francisco occurred around 1978 and were linked to a transfection from New York City in 1976. After additional analysis of the HIV genome in patient zero, it appeared that this genome was typical of HIV strains in the U.S. and not those of the Caribbean, where it was always assumed that Dugas had contracted the virus. Consequently, because they didn't come from the Caribbean, Gaëtan Dugas can no longer be blamed as the original source of HIV in the U.S. So probably somewhere out there, Gaëtan is smiling because he's no longer being blamed for the deaths of so many. All right, last story of the night. Did you really think you could escape a month without me talking about microbiomes again? You are wrong, mon frère. Quite wrong. So, what now about microbiomes, you're asking? Can the wrong gut bugs cause you to be a Nazi? Well, no. Still no. Probably never no. However, Dr. Federico Ray of the University of Wisconsin reports this month in the journal Molecular Cell that gut microbes affect epigenetic patterns in multiple host tissues, and that a Western-type diet abolishes those effects in mice, according to a new study. Remember, epigenetics is the study of how the environment changes genetics in an individual and their offspring. Frankly, the findings from this study could have significant implications for our understanding of the complex interactions between diet, the microbiome, and, well, host health. Ray says, quote, "As we move away from plant-based diets and into diets heavy in processed foods, Westerners may be losing some of the communication between microbes and host," unquote. Through fermentation, gut bacteria metabolize complex carbohydrates to produce short-chain fatty acids like acetate, propionate, and butyrate. These small organic acids have both disease-promoting and therapeutic effects, but the underlying molecular mechanisms are still unclear. The enzymes that modify histones to regulate transcription epigenetics, these regulatory enzymes are sensitive to the availability of small molecule metabolites like acetate, propionate, and butyrate, and thus they enable DNA and chromatin to respond to changes in the chemical milieu and environment. In the new study, Ray set out to examine whether gut microbial metabolites absorbed and metabolized by the host have similar effects. And to address that question, his team examined histone post-translational modification states in mice that were either exposed to microbes or kept in a germ-free environment. They found that gut microbes alter host histone acetylation and methylation not only in the colon, which is in direct contact with microbes and their metabolites, but also in tissues outside the gut. Now remember, methylation adds a chemical group to DNA that causes it to fold up like a concertina and close down activity. The opposite of that, histone acetylation, does, well, the exact opposite, causing the DNA to open up and become more active so that genes are turned on. Now the interesting part is that bacteria in our gut have the ability to turn genes on and off long-term across generations. Mice that were given a typical Western diet high in sugar and fat suppressed the microbial production of short-chain fatty acids and abolished the effects of gut microbes on host chromatin states. In short, the probiotic effects of the gut microbes were diminished and they no longer were able to affect expression of our genes. The really cool thing is that by supplementing the diet of the mice with short-chain fatty acids, that was actually sufficient to recapitulate those microbe-driven chromatin and transcriptional effects, turn them back on, so that the gene regulatory balance was returned to their diets. Based on the findings, Ray proposes that eukaryotic histone-modifying enzymes have evolved to sense not only endogenous metabolites in our guts, but also those metabolites produced by gut microbes. The study may have important clinical implications, given that gut microbes have been linked to cardiovascular disease, obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and inflammatory bowel disorders, rampant Nazism. All right, I'm kidding about the last one. Well, I guess for now, it just remains unclear exactly how specific short-chain fatty acids, again, acetates, butyrates, propionates, how they each contribute to the beneficial or pathogenic effects on the host. Well, that's all for now. As always, take care. Pull out those earbuds if you want to stay private. Keep your probiotic gut bacteria happy with a good diet. Remember, walk heel-toe unless you're on a catwalk modeling clothes. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.